can't tell. Can you all hear me? Is this on? How about now? It sounds a little bit better. All right. Well, welcome back. It's been a few weeks since I was up here doing this, but tonight what we're going to do is something we probably should have done at the beginning of 2017, end of 2017 when we began a survey of the Old Testament, and that is take a couple weeks to introduce the material, the structure, what's happening, what to look for, and that kind of idea as we progress through the New Testament. So tonight and next week, assuming we cover all the material that I have planned, just 2 weeks, we will be talking about an introduction to the New Testament. And because we now have several thousand years of history, as we approach the New Testament, we are going to begin with just a quick recap, looking back at the Old Testament and what happened through all those books. If you're going to begin, you begin at the beginning, the book of Genesis. Those first five books, Genesis through Deuteronomy, in these books, God formed the nation of Israel, established their national laws as a theocracy. A theocracy is a government with God as the true head and man organized underneath God's direct rule. And it also, these five books also recount how God brought them out of Egypt into the promised land. And then beginning in Joshua, I'm sorry, not into the promised land, but to the promised land. Beginning in Joshua, you see how God brings them into the promised land, how they drive out the Canaanites because they were wicked and replace their cities with their own cities and begin to inhabit the land that God had promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And then we move to Judges. The people are now living in the land. They've organized under Israel's theocracy with God ruling them, using the priests to teach the people the laws that he had given them. Unfortunately, it failed. Not because God's system was bad, but because men were wicked. In the book of Judges, we are repeatedly confronted with a cycle. The people forgot God's goodness. That's a big theme in this book. They forgot what God had done for the nation. And when they forgot, they began to worship the Canaanite deities. They worshiped the Canaanite deities, and soon God chastened them, sent a foreign power to conquer them, and they lived under tribute in a hardship for a while. But because they knew God and they eventually remembered everything he had done for them, it wasn't long before they said, aha, we need to turn back to God. And when they did, they repented and they resumed their worship of God after he restored them to their independence, restored their power, their control over themselves. But eventually, not long, a generation maybe, they repeat the cycle, continue, and they forget God's goodness. And it just keeps going and going and going. But every time the cycle continues and happens again, they continually get down and further and further and further into depravity. The cycle of their sin gets worse and worse each time. By the time you get to the end of Judges, there are some very, very serious accounts in those final chapters that describe the wicked state of the nation. Judges ends and transitions into another account, one that is a lot more happy, a lot more uplifting. Ruth. In this book, godly Boaz and Ruth became the unlikely ancestors of King David. And as we said when we were discussing these books in our survey of the Old Testament, I know I'm asking you to remember back over a year ago at this point, so I'll just quickly say, we said Samuel was the author of these books from Judges, Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel. He wrote Judges, he wrote Ruth, introducing himself in 1 Samuel as the prophet when King Saul was anointed. But with 1 Samuel, we have to understand that King Saul was never going to be the promised monarch who was going to be the ancestor of the Messiah. Why do I say that? Well, Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin, but Jacob prophesied in Genesis 49:10. Let's go ahead and turn there. Genesis chapter 49, verse 10. Jacob prophesied here in this verse that the king, the Messiah, would come from the line of Judah, and that his right to rule would come from the line of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So in this verse, we kind of have an indication already that God was not intending for Saul's line, the Benjaminite line, to continue as the perpetual monarchy over Israel. He wanted a king from the tribe of Judah. God's mercies for Saul's family in his line was very limited. As a matter of fact, it wasn't very long before he took away the kingdom from Saul and gave it to David. Now, there was a time of transition in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles. In this time, King David began to replace King Saul. He went to the king, started to learn what the king was doing. He started fighting in the wars, gained a reputation in the nation as a mighty man of war, and eventually was set up as king after King Saul was killed by the Philistines. With King David's assumption of that role, the monarchy, the eternal Jewish monarchy that would culminate with the king, the Messiah, who would rule for all eternity, was established. 1 and 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles discuss the remainder of Jewish history prior to the exile. In this time, we see that the cycle of forgetting God and turning to wickedness just continues to get worse. Time and time again, they have a wicked king who gets worse. They might occasionally have a good king. The northern kingdom did not have any of those, any really good kings. But the southern kingdom had a few. And it wasn't long, a few hundred years, before both kingdoms, the north and the south, had descended into deep depravity, and God had sent them away into exile in Babylon. So from there, we're going to skip over the books of poetry and the major prophets. We're going to jump to the minor prophets. These are the ones we studied last, so they should be freshest in our minds, right? You remember? Okay, maybe not. But so we're looking at Jonah. God's mercy to Nineveh allowed the northern kingdom to descend into its worst state. So at the end of the history of the northern kingdom, God actually gave them mercy. He allowed the kingdom of Assyria, the empire of Assyria, to be temporarily restrained. This empire continually infringed the northern borders of Israel, and in that violence had brought, you know, a lot of heartache to the people. But when God sent Jonah, they quit attacking. And in this time that the people should have turned to God and recognized his mercy to them, instead of becoming more righteous, they just used that extra time, that extra money that they received from their lack of war, and they put it into pursuing more wicked, more lavish lifestyles. And ultimately, they descended into an even worse state than they had been when Nineveh was attacking them. Hosea then brought God's final message of impending judgment to the northern kingdom. So the northern kingdom is out of the way with Hosea. Moving on in these minor prophets, though, we find again the same general picture happening with the southern kingdom as they too descend into worse and worse corruption. In Habakkuk, we find Babylon would attack and conquer the southern kingdom after King Josiah's death. So we have a very approximate time there. And then with Daniel, we see a righteous, high-ranking Jew prophesying from Babylon about the intertestamental period, the coming Messiah, and the end times. And we're going to look at Daniel a little bit more tonight because we're going to discuss that intertestamental period, which means between the testaments. We'll get to that in a few minutes. And he really gives us a lot of information in anticipation of what's coming, looking ahead. And it's very fascinating to read these prophecies and then compare them to what we know of throughout history. Also, while the Jews were in Babylon, we see the book of Esther. Although unmentioned by name, God preserved the Jews during the exile using a series of divinely orchestrated events. It's fascinating that although God's name is not actually mentioned exactly in this book, it's hard to find a book where his providence is more clearly shown in a story. It's so obvious how God took Esther, put her in the right position where she could have an impact on the king when a wicked man was going to try to destroy the nation of Israel in exile. After Esther, we find Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, and Zechariah. These four men worked during the 70 years, or after the 70 years of captivity ended, and they talk about how the Jews returned to the Promised Land, and they rebuilt the temple, they rebuilt Jerusalem. Now, although they did experience God's judgment, we also find in these books that the people still had not learned their lesson, and they were still having trouble obeying his instructions. And finally, we get to the last book in the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. The priests, this is the theme that we discussed as we looked at this book in our survey of the Old Testament. The priests, who were supposed to be God's messengers, failed to obey God's prophets. Consequently, God would not send another messenger until Elijah figuratively, because that was fulfilled in John the Baptist, who Jesus likened unto Elijah, announced the coming of the Lord to his temple. Now Malachi, when we studied it, we said from one messenger to another as a little subtitle for the book. There was a double meaning to that subtitle. First, Malachi's name means messenger, and his entire book is given to the messengers of God, the priests. Now those priests failed. So Malachi's message from one messenger to the others was that because you failed, I'm not going to send another prophet. The double meaning is that from one messenger to another, Malachi to John the Baptist, there would not be another prophet in the prophetic office. That time is what we now look at as the intertestamental period. And that's our second point that we're discussing tonight. The intertestamental period, literally between testaments, also known as the 400 silent years. And when we look at our timeline in a few minutes, we'll see it's actually just a few years longer than 400, but 400 silent years is what it's called. The prophetic office during this time was empty, and there was no messenger from God. That was in fulfillment of Malachi's prophecy. And, you know, I think it's interesting. I've got a few verses up here and on your note sheets for you to look at. These are actually taken from the Apocrypha. They're not part of our Bible for this very reason. 1 Maccabees 4:45b through 46. So they tore down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill until there should come a prophet to tell what to do with them. They were looking for a prophet. They didn't have a prophet. And then again, in 9:27, thus there was great distress in Israel, such as had not been since the time that prophets ceased to appear among them. Again, this is a historical account written by a man who is not divinely inspired, because God had removed that prophetic office during these 400 silent years. And they recognized that there wasn't a prophet. And again, in 14:41, and the Jews and their priests decided that Simon should be their leader and high priest forever until a trustworthy prophet should arise. So even the people who lived during these 400 silent years recognized that they were missing a prophet. They didn't have someone divinely inspired by God to bring his word to them. Incidentally, just want to make this point really quick. Since the prophetic office was empty, and the people even recognized that, this is a very good reason why we do not include the apocryphal books, those books that were written between the Old Testament and the New Testament, in our canon, the accepted books of the Bible. So let's look really quick at the timeline of the intertestamental period. I hope you all can read that up there. The first is Malachi's prophecy. We assigned a date of 430 BC for that as we went through the Old Testament. If he ended his prophecy around 430 BC, he was ministering in a Persian world. At this time, the Persian Empire had rule not just over what was the Babylonian Empire, but also Israel, and was pushing its way into Asia Minor, going up towards Greece. 100 years later, in 330 BC, with the Battle of Thermopylae, you have the beginning of the fall of the Persian Empire. Now, this was the change of the balance of power. So the Persians encountered the Grecians in this battle, and the Grecians won. Why is that significant? Well, it ushered in the Greek Empire. Greek Empire under Alexander the Great then responded to their push west with a very swift attack to the east. And in 7 years, Alexander the Great found himself drinking in despair that there was no more land for him to conquer. As a matter of fact, he died just 7 years later because he drank himself to death for that reason. And with his death, his great empire, it was huge, taking over Israel, then the Persian Empire, was split into four sections. Two of those sections, the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemies in the south, had control over Israel. These two subdivisions of the empire ruled over the land of Israel for several hundred years, until the time of one Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was that great and cruel ruler of the Seleucids who actually came and offered a pig at the altar of the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the Jews do not like pigs. They think they are absolutely unclean. They will not touch them. So for a Gentile to not only offer a pig on the altar, but to do it in the holy place, the Holy of Holies, absolutely defiled their temple. And as you can imagine, it turned a lot of the people's minds against the Greeks. So just a few years later, the Maccabees, you'll recognize that name from the verses, or I guess maybe you'd call them verses, the parts of the historical account that we just read. The Maccabees rose up and led the nation of Israel to throw off Greek rule in 166 BC. So they ruled under the Hasmonean dynasty, and that was the dynasty they established, for about 100 years until internal strife brought the Roman Empire to establish its own rule in 63 BC. They, in turn, after a short time, established Herod the Great as the king of Jerusalem and Judea in 37 BC, and Herod the Great was the king when Jesus was born in 5 BC. So you can kind of see now how the time progressed from Malachi's prophecy through the Greek Empire, the fall of the Greek Empire, the division, the Israelites rebelling and setting up their own rule, then Rome moving in, and then Jesus being born. But now I want to move to the book of Daniel. I want to spend some good time here tonight because this is really fascinating to see how Daniel, with God's revelation, prophesied some very specific information about the time between the testaments when there wasn't a prophet and the people actually had this information all along. So we're going to look at Daniel 2, 21 through 45. It's a little bit of a longer passage here. And actually, because it is a little bit longer, we're going to skip ahead to verse 31. I should say 31 through 45, I think. This is Daniel talking to King Nebuchadnezzar, who had asked his wise men to tell him what his own dream had been. They were flabbergasted. It wasn't something that was in their job description, they thought. But Daniel received the information from God in a dream, in a vision, and then went to the king and told him, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and break them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This, then, is the interpretation, these next several verses. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So they're talking to King Nebuchadnezzar. Keep that in mind. This is the first kingdom. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. Now that was true. Remember, God had set up the Babylonians to be a powerful kingdom that could come in and judge his people in the land of Israel for their sin against him. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar's at the top. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So it starts with the head of gold. This was the Babylonian Empire, and continues on to the Medo-Persian Empire, which was the breast and arms of silver. This was the empire that took over and defeated the Babylonians just a few generations after Nebuchadnezzar. But then it wasn't very long, as we saw, about 330 BC, before the Persian Empire started to decline and was replaced by Alexander the Great with his Greek Empire. This is the belly and thighs of brass. And eventually, they too were defeated by an even stronger and more ruthless empire, the Roman Empire, the legs of iron. So really, the Babylonian Empire is the only one that wasn't during this intertestamental period. The Medo-Persians, the Greek, and the Romans were all falling into these 400 silent years. But Daniel gives a second prophecy just a little bit later in chapter 7 that gives a lot more detail about these kingdoms. Let's just turn a few chapters over. We only have four verses to read this time. Daniel 7, 3 through 7. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man. And a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, we're not going to get into the 10 horns part. That's part of even in the future for us. So for tonight, we're just looking at that part that discusses the beasts. The first, the lion with eagle's wings, is the Babylonian Empire. The second, The Medo-Persian Empire is the bear with three ribs. The third, the leopard with four wings and four heads, is the Greek Empire. And the fourth, the last, is the Roman Empire, this dreadful and exceeding strong beast that trampled the rest of the previous empires and unified them under its iron rule. Let's look at these a little bit more closely. The Babylonian Empire, the lion with eagle's wings. I think it's fascinating. As I've looked at some of this stuff throughout my studies in the past, I've seen some pictures of the gate Isthar that was in Babylon. And it's very obvious that either this image became well known as a representation of Nebuchadnezzar, that it was his image, or it became his image after this prophecy. Because here's a representation drawing of what is on that gate. Notice the lion, and then very clearly the wings on the lion. So this is a reproduction of one of the lions that's on the gate. I only used a drawing here because I couldn't find a more detailed picture that was in public domain. So this is what it looks like. It's a very good representation of it. But as you can see coming off the front leg there, that is a wing. And I think it's amazing that this symbol was well known in that time during the empire. So the wings were plucked, and it was given a man's heart. I believe this is referring to the time when Nebuchadnezzar was humbled after living like a beast. So Nebuchadnezzar he may very well have become a true believer, and that may be indicated by the fact that the wings were plucked and he stood up like a man, and he began to think correctly like a man. So he may have become a true believer. The second beast, the Medo-Persian Empire, the bear with three ribs. Now there's a couple of possibilities of what these three ribs might symbolize. The first is that they might symbolize the three dominant tribes of the Persian Empire. Now these three, as defined by Herodotus in his histories, are the Pasargadae, the Marafi, and the Maspi. And really quick, I'm just going to read this quote. The Persian nation contains a number of tribes as listed here. The Pasargadae, the Marafi, and the Maspi, upon which all the other tribes are dependent. Of these, the Pasargadae are the most distinguished. They contain the clan of the Achaemenids, from which spring the Persid kings. And then it goes on to list a couple of the others and how they were divided, some farming and some more nomadic. So that's one possibility. That's what Herodotus wrote. But there's another possibility, and I tend to think that this is more of what is intended, that these three ribs symbolize the three main parts of the empire: Persia, Media, and Babylon. So I think they're probably more likely to be symbolized in this way because they're in its mouth, meaning that it had devoured them. And a conquered land could be termed devoured. The bear symbolized the empire. In its action, it rose up on one side, showing that one side of the empire, Persia, would be stronger than the other. And as we look through history, we find that the two, Medes and the Persians, which started out as an alliance, were ultimately overwhelmed by the stronger party, the Persians. And there's actually another prophecy of the same time in history that demonstrates the same thing. One horn becoming larger than the other horn and having more strength. The Greek Empire, this third beast, is the leopard with four wings and four heads. Now the leopard showed that the conquering would be swift. And the fact that there were four wings probably indicates that there were four generals that also helped him to succeed in this conquering. The four heads prophesied the four-way division of Alexander's empire after his death. We discussed a little bit earlier that two of those, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, had direct authority over Israel after he died. The Ptolemies were in the south, and the Seleucids were in the north. The northern king, Antiochus Epiphanes, or the descendant of the northern king, persecuted the Jews and defiled their temple by offering pigs on the altar. The Jews, led by the Maccabees, successfully revolted and established the Hasmonean dynasty in Jerusalem, and they also took over the role of high priest, although they were not descended from Zadok. So let's, you don't have to turn there. I'm going to read it really quick. Ezekiel 48:11. It shall be for the priests that are sanctified of the sons of Zadok, which have kept my charge, which went not astray when the children of Israel went astray, as the Levites went astray. So the children of Zadok were supposed to be purified, or had demonstrated their purity in the past, and for that reason they had been designated the role of the high priest from then on. The Maccabeans were not part of that priestly line. They still established themselves as the high priest. The fourth empire, the Roman Empire, was dreadful and exceedingly strong. It was the beast that trampled the rest of the previous empires under its iron rule. So iron is very strong, and Rome was a strong empire and succeeded in unifying a lot of the world and forcing peace. And that's very important because as we come into next week, we will discuss how God used these empires to establish a perfect time for his son to come into the world, the fullness of time, as it says in the New Testament. And we'll look at what that means a little bit more. The Roman Empire assumed authority over Israel after defeating the Grecian Empire. At first, they allowed Israel to be somewhat self-governing. They were there, kind of watching, but the Hasmonean dynasty could not keep the peace among themselves, and eventually two rival parties started getting at it with each other, and the empire came in and established Herod the Great as the authority in Jerusalem after that power struggle. This Herod was king when Christ was born, but it was not the same Herod as the one Jesus appeared before during his trial right before his death. Also, in this intertestamental period, there are a few really important developments that we want to talk about really quick. The first is the Septuagint, also known as LXX, which is the number 70. During the intertestamental period, the importance of Greek culture cannot be overstated. So although it was very corrupt, God used it as a tool to ensure that the New Testament was quickly spread around the known world by establishing a common language that was Greek. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. So they were themselves more readily accessible to the people in the region. Another key development was the establishment of a group known as the Pharisees. This group of leaders opposed Greek influence in Jewish society. So they were against Hellenism. Hellenism is a somewhat unusual word. It's not one we use every day. But simply put, it means establishing Greek culture in your country as what you are. So a Greek identity, kind of. And key aspects of Hellenism included architecture, language, and religion. Also, sports and all kinds of Greek life. That was Alexander's primary influence on the lands that he conquered. He wanted to bring Greek culture, what is known as Hellenism. Again, we'll look at that a little bit more next week. The Pharisees were against that. They probably formed at the same time as the Hasmonean dynasty, and they probably became a unique entity when the Hasmonean dynasty, the Maccabees, after they had successfully repelled Greek culture, eventually turned to it themselves, and they continued to oppose it, separating out from the dynasty. Another important development is the establishment of the Sadducees. You'll recognize some of these names now because we're getting into groups that were very important in the New Testament. The Sadducees were Hellenized, that means they had adopted Greek culture, Hellenized descendants of Zadok, who eventually resumed the high priestly role. So these were supposed to be the high priests. These were the people who were supposed to be the high priests. Unfortunately, they rejected all books of the Old Testament except the Pentateuch and also some very important doctrines. There were some very unique differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and there's an anecdote in Acts 23, verses 6 through 9, that highlights these differences and how much the two groups really did not like each other. I'm just going to read those verses really quick. Paul is using this difference to take the attention off of himself and put it on their differences. So he's speaking here to a group of people composed of Pharisees and Sadducees. In 23, verses 6 through 9, "But when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, 'Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Of the hope and resurrection of the dead I am called in question.' And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees' part arose and strove, saying, 'We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.'" So probably for the one time in all the New Testament, a Christian had the Pharisees on his side because he was able to point out their differences and make use of them. The scribes and the rabbis were also another important development during this intertestamental period. These were people who taught the Old Testament scriptures to prevent another exile from lack of knowledge. So after the exile returned, there was a great belief that one reason the people had fallen into such wickedness was because they did not have knowledge, enough knowledge about God to avoid it. And that is taken from Hosea 4:6, which says, "My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge." The scribes and the rabbis made it their mission to teach the people so that they would avoid such an exile again. The last development is one that came towards the end of this period. This is Gabriel's messages. The intertestamental period began to end when the angel Gabriel came to Zechariah, Mary, and Joseph with messages about John the Baptist and the coming Messiah who were going to be born. To these three people, he announced their births miraculously. John the Baptist would be identified by Jesus later as the Elijah of Malachi, who would come before his coming to prepare the way. The important fact is that Gabriel could not come with this message until God had decided the time was right, until the fullness of time had come. As I mentioned, we will study that concept more next week as we continue the introduction to the New Testament. For tonight, however, since we're almost out of time, I want to just move on to application. And that application is that we can be confident throughout life because we know that God is sovereign. This has been an application before as we work through the Old Testament, but I think it's appropriate to look at it again tonight. Just think about everything God has done throughout history. In the past 45 minutes, we've crammed about 4,000 or 5,000 years of history into 45 minutes, just talking about how God has worked in the nation of Israel, even though they had sinned, to bring about his plan. He divinely established the nation of Israel, and when they turned from him, he judged them. Yet God still worked through these judgments to ensure they were protected. That's the story of Esther and other instances as well. The prophet Daniel, he gave this prophet exact details down to how many kingdoms the Greek Empire would be split into after Alexander's death. This was well over 100 years, probably 200 years before Alexander's empire began. The progression of history set the stage for events we will see as we begin to work through the New Testament. And God controlled all of them, bringing them perfectly into alignment so that he could send his son to a world that was prepared for a rapid expansion of the message of the Messiah. So let's think about it. If God was so capable of demonstrating his sovereignty in the ages past, is he not capable of directing your life tonight, today, right now, to bring his will to pass in your life? Nothing that happens to you takes God by surprise. As a matter of fact, he's seen it and known it and can use it for your good. Romans 8:28. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Now this should give us comfort, because it's not our responsibility to control the events of our lives. All we need to do is love God and follow his instructions. It'll give us comfort if we trust him. Worry never accomplished anything good, because generally the things that we worry about don't come to pass anyway. We just try to take into our control things that we should leave with God. If we trust in God, then we can be confident, because we know that he will work for us and work his will to the best. So we can be confident throughout our lives because we know that God is sovereign. And I think that is a very pertinent application that we can take from just a brief glimpse at the Old Testament history leading up to the New Testament, the intertestamental period. So that is all for tonight. Thank you very much for coming. We'll resume next week with a continuing introduction to the New Testament. At this point, let's divide up for prayer.